Deuteronomy 30, 11 to 20. Now what I am commanding you today is not too difficult for you or beyond your reach. It is not up in heaven so that you have to ask, who will ascend into heaven and get it and proclaim it to us so we may obey it? Nor is it beyond the sea so that you have to ask, who will cross the sea and get it and proclaim it to us so that we may obey it? No, the word is very near you. It is in your mouth and in your heart, so you may obey it. See, I set before you today life and prosperity, death and destruction. For I command you today to love the Lord your God, to walk in obedience to him, and to keep his commands, decrees, and laws. Then you will live and increase, and the Lord your God will bless you in the land you are entering to possess. But if your heart turns away and you are not obedient, and if you are drawn away to bow down to other gods and worship them, I declare to you this day that you will certainly be destroyed. You will not live long in the land you are crossing the Jordan to enter and possess. This day I call the heavens and earth as witnesses against you that I have set before you life and death, blessings and curses. Now choose life so that you and your children may live, and that you may love the Lord your God, listen to his voice, and hold fast to him. For the Lord is your life, and he will give you many years in the land he swore to give your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.
I will be reading from Galatians 5:16-25. If you are guided by the Spirit, you won't obey your selfish desires. The Spirit and your desires are enemies of each other. They are always fighting each other and keeping you from doing what you feel you should. But if you obey the Spirit, the law of Moses has no control over you. People's desires make them give in to immoral ways, filthy thoughts, and shameful deeds. They worship idols, practice witchcraft, hate others, and are hard to get along with others. People become jealous, angry, and selfish. They not only argue, cause trouble, but they are envious, they get drunk, carry on their wild parties, and do other evil things as well. I told you before, I am telling you again, no one who does these things will share in their blessings of God's kingdom. God's Spirit makes us loving, happy, peaceful, patient, kind, good, faithful, gentle, and self-controlled. There is no law against behaving in any of these ways. And because we belong to Christ Jesus, we have killed our selfish feelings and desires. God's Spirit has given us life, and so should we follow the Spirit. But don't be conceited and make others jealous by claiming to be better than they are.
1 Corinthians 9, 24 and 25. Do you not know that in a race all the runners run, but only one gets the prize? Run in such a way as to get the prize. Everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training. They do it to get a crown that will not last, but we do it to get a crown that will last forever.
Just wanted to start by saying that when you arrived in the doors this morning, you were handed a little slip of paper like this, and were offered a pencil or pen. Therefore, a little later, just so you know. So there was the weekend I took four of my nephews on a weekend camp out, and all four of them were aged around 13 to 14, that age where adventure and crazy are not very far apart from each other. Our rustic cabin was a gift from a friend of mine. It was set on a lake that is about a mile long. Page Lake is shaped like a finger, a long, slender expanse of water with a dam breast down at the far end, and our cabin was on the opposite end, the shallow end, where the feeder streams enter it and where lily pads tangle up the fishing lines. Our cabin was secluded from other Laker cabins by a large expanse of woods, and so we were pretty much left to our own devices, which in hindsight may not have been the best place for adventuresome boys with a knack for crazy. and which upon further hindsight may not have been the best time for their uncle to take a nap. Since we were camping at the back end of the lake, the shallow end with lily pads and mud, the only way to get decent swimming was to take a raft out to deeper water. Out the long dock, to the raft, with blue plastic barrels beneath it and two sets of oars, which my four nephews used as poles to poke and to propel themselves forward. They looked like Tom Sawyers and Huck Finns as they pushed off from shore to go swimming. Well, it wasn't long before an accidental oar splash happened, and then another, and things began to escalate from there into a full skirmish of flying seaweed and slippery lily pads being yanked loose and flung at each other, all, of course, with hooligan laughter. And so then what do you do when a truce is finally called for and you notice everyone aboard is laced with mud and head to toe? Well, you move out to deeper waters to swim and to get cleaned off, and they did. But there were circumstances. There were some circumstances. For one, a long finger-shaped lake tucked in between two ridges is subject to the winds that tunnel up through the valley. It may have been calm ashore next to the sheltered cabin, but out there on the water, there was, shall we say, a fresh breeze, and it was a factor. Another circumstance would be is that these four nephews of mine were all landlubber types, two Kentuckians, a Pennsylvania, and a New Yorker, with no water experience whatsoever between them. And maybe that since four were landlubbers, no notice was taken of the short anchor chain that was meant for fishing the shallows, not for the deeps. And they did not notice the fresh breeze had begun to drift them up the lake. It was all fun in the sun for a while with swimming and splash and seaweed and adventure and plenty of boyish make-believe until from a distance they noticed their cabin getting smaller until it was too late. And it may have been a factor that their uncle was a snooze in the cabin and did not notice their predicament. Four boys with four oars paddling frantically but steadily losing ground to the wind, drifting further into the water skiing lanes. Not scared much, they said, but caught up in a losing battle nonetheless. They were rescued on the open waters by a fellow Laker in his motorboat. He had noticed them, their plight, tossed them a rope, and trolled them back to within reach of the cabin, for which they were grateful as he nodded his rescue approval when he left. On the return raft of mud and seaweed were four tired boys, two Kentuckians minus their eyeglasses, which had been lost at sea in the fracas, who still had to face their mother, four sunburned boys a little wiser for their afternoon wear on the high seas of adventure and crazy, and one could ask, could anything have been different? Had anything could have been different with a yes or a no? This morning we are continuing with our series on the practices of Christian faith, and to date we have talked about three: the practice of honoring the bodies that we have been given. Hospitality came up second, and last week we touched on simplicity as a life practice. And to boot, last week there was a vigorous need what you take what you need response to Allison's working visual of things last week. Today's Christian practice is called saying yes and saying no. And I wanted to use my nephew's adventure as a way of suggesting that saying yes and no is never a once and done. It is never a game-ending slam dunk, but instead, yeses and nos come within the flow of our lives, all of our lives. And one can only wonder what their adventure on the lake would have looked like had there been a strong no component and a well-placed yes. I also wanted to use their grand adventure as a way to keep our spiritual feet on the ground's surface, that yesing and knowing are earthbound practices all the way through our lives. This morning, Twyla read the lesson from the book of Deuteronomy, and as we have said other times here at Marion, the Bible's kind of like a library made up of 66 different books, And some of those 66 books are very different from each other. There's history and poetry, and there are handwritten letters, and there are gospels. And what on earth is with the book of Revelation? What is with that strange book? Miss Monica is taking an Old Testament survey course this fall at Fuller Seminary, and she sent me a message the other week about her prof saying how different the book of Jonah is from all of the others, that it ends with a question when none of the other books do. Some of the books of the Bible are just very different from each other. Now, the book of Deuteronomy actually took a long time to complete. Some think almost two full centuries from start to finish. And many think that the book of Deuteronomy is actually more akin to what we now know as a sermon, a speech written down. That Deuteronomy is actually made up of three different sermons, three speeches, and the reading we heard from Twyla this morning is the beginning of sermon number three. She did a good job to bring oral integrity to the reading, the language, how a sermon implores, and notice, like my nephew's grand adventure, how close to the ground, how close to everyday life the speech is. Surely this commandment that I am giving you today is not too hard for you. It is not too far away. It's not in heaven that you should say, who will go up to heaven for us and get it so that we may hear it and observe it. Neither is it beyond the sea that you should say, who will cross over to the other side of the sea for us and get it so that we may hear it and observe it. No. The word is very near you. It's in your mouth. It's in your heart for you to observe right here. And notice, too, in this sermon, the yesing and the knowing that is going on, the choosing between those things that give life and those things that suck the life out of us. Choices between loving God or turning towards other idols. The choosing between what blesses and what curses. Choosing between staying the course or being drifting off course. Choosing life down here on the ground. Saying yes and no is a practice ground. It is not a slam dunk. It is not stuck in heaven or across the Atlantic Ocean, but it is very near, very close in our mouths, close up. On Monday, as some of you probably are aware, Eugene Peterson passed away. This week, a number of testimonials have been appearing on blogs and quotes of his on Facebook posts. We do tend to notice it more when someone rather famous passes from us. Eugene Peterson was famous for saying things like, churches should not be getting larger, they should be getting smaller. For it is there where care for each other happens, in smaller churches. Imagine that. He also said, for a Christian to live in our present world will be like one long obedience in the same direction, with plenty of yeses and nos. Eugene Peterson was most famous for writing the Bible version we call The Message. If you have a copy of the Bible called The Message on your bookshelf, thank Eugene Peterson for it. He had wanted people and their Bibles to be closer together to each other. So he went ahead and studied the ancient languages and produced a Bible in a more contemporary language. Now, highbrow critics are not all that fond of The Message. However, first-time readers of the Bible are. This morning, I'd like to read a tribute to Eugene Peterson. Usually, I don't like to cut-paste something this lengthy into a sermon, but I think it's worth hearing. This particular tribute comes from a man named Mark Roberts, and he writes about Mr. Peterson's character. Mark calls it Eugene Peterson when no one was looking. Here it is. My story comes over 10 years ago. I had just begun as the senior director of Lady Lodge, an idyllic retreat center in the Texas Hill Country. In this role, I helped facilitate a variety of retreats. One of those was a private retreat for a group of influential, successful Christian writers. You couldn't just show up at this retreat because you had written a few blog posts or even a few books. You had to be invited personally by this exclusive group, one that included Eugene Peterson among its members. When my 15-year-old son Nathan learned that Eugene Peterson was going to be at this retreat, he asked excitedly if he could come along and meet him. Nathan loved Eugene's Bible translation, The Message, and wanted to get to the man who wrote the Bible to sign his book. I told Nathan he was welcome to join me at the retreat. But when we showed up, I was immediately awkward. Though I was newly in charge of the retreat center and the writers were effectively in my place, some of them regarded me as an interloper, a few almost rude in their pompous response to my presence there, and they were even less pleased that a teenager was alongside me. I wasn't making a good impression on this group, that's for sure. Nevertheless, Nathan and I sat through the first session, and as soon as it ended, I walked over to Eugene Peterson. I introduced myself and then introduced Nathan. I explained that Nathan loved the message and wanted to meet the man who wrote it. I asked if Eugene would be willing to sign Nathan's Bible, and Eugene pleasantly said yes, and asked Nathan about himself. A minute later, I was called away into another conversation, leaving Nathan to fend for himself. I figured he'd get Eugene's signature, and that would be it. My conversation ended up lasting for about 15 minutes or so, and when it was over, I began looking for Nathan. And I scanned the room filled with famous Christian writers and poets and one teenager, and at first I couldn't spot Nathan. I figured maybe he went back to our room. Then as I made my way through the literary movers and shakers, I saw Nathan talking with Eugene Peterson, and they were deeply engaged in conversation. As I watched, I marveled. Eugene didn't seem at all bored with Nathan or eager to move on to someone else of greater stature. The esteemed author didn't calculate which of the writers would be the most strategic for conversation. He didn't wrap up quickly with Nathan so he could get on to more important people. For Eugene, Nathan, the least accomplished person in the room at the time, was the most important person in the room at the time. I'm quite sure it never dawned on Eugene that he was doing anything unusual or praiseworthy by spending so much time talking to Nathan. He simply was doing what he did, caring for the person right in front of him, listening to his or her life, sharing his own life in return. Eugene was, as the King James Version says of God, no respecter of persons. When nobody was looking, Eugene was, well, rather like Jesus. The other scripture lesson that we heard read for us this morning was from the book of Galatians. Probably we were not counting the two lists as they were read for us, but there's a 15er and a 9er. Many of us have heard these two lists before. The 15er has fornication, impurity, licentiousness, idolatry, sorcery, enmity, strife, jealousy, anger, quarrels, dissensions, factions, envy, drunkenness, and carousing. Ah, the bad list. Don't want to be on that list. Boo the bad list. Do the 9er list instead. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, generosity, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Yeah, let's do that list. Yahoo for the 9er. But it is probably a mistake to think the line between these two lists are so clearly defined, that we either fall on one side or the other, that either we're a classic 15er or a world champion 9er. Probably not the case. It wasn't with Nathan and Mr. Peterson in their room full of arrogant Christian writers. Envy and gentleness were together on display in the same Christian room. Probably the same with any of us also. The lists are probably closer together than we care to admit. And probably why, in another church letter, Paul uses the metaphor of an athlete, that to run this race called life, we will have to get ourselves into shape. Choices to make regarding how we live our lives. That something good on the 9er list like self-control or kindness will not come to us FedExed overnight, but instead are life practices, yes to some, no to others. Now the piece of paper, and if you have a pencil or pen available, I want us to take some think time. I know for those of us who are more geared towards the introverted side of things, think time is a very valuable and needed thing to have. I want us to take just a few minutes of quiet time to think and to review, where is my life right now? Let's face it, the Christian life is not a spectator activity, it is a full participation activity in the way we relate to God, the way we relate to other human beings, and the way we relate to the natural world around us. In choosing life, we will do well to learn the practice of saying no and saying yes. No to those things which crowd God out, and saying yes to those things which make space for God. So take a couple of quiet minutes to think and to review. For whom and for who am I living? For whom and for what am I living my life? What about my week is most necessary? Maybe looking back, anything last week need to be earmarked with a no? Anything coming this week require a yes? I simply want us to take 2 minutes of think time and review time. And maybe one thing, either a yes or no, will become clear to you, and you simply write it down. You're not handing these in, not that, but it may be worthwhile taking the next step of what you've written down and to confide with a person who is close to you, a spiritual friend. For it's one thing, as Elizabeth said earlier, to have beliefs and concepts in our head. It's quite another thing to take things out of our head, put it down on paper, and take the next step towards being a more compassionate and more godly person. Take some time to think.